Hi, before we start today, I just want to flag that we're going to be recording a special St. Patrick's Day podcast next week, looking back at the politics of the pandemic over the past year. We would like to hear your questions and we will do our best to answer them if you can send them into politicspodcast@irishtimes.com by Monday, March the 15th. You can send them in writing, but we would really like to hear your voice, so audio format would be even better. Now, on with today's show. It's Friday, March the 12th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. The most popular article on irishtimes.com this week, and probably for the entire year so far, was our columnist Patrick Frayne's somewhat tongue-in-cheek analysis of the fallout from the interview given by the UK's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to Oprah Winfrey. The interview was also the most popular programme screened on RTE so far this year, and of course its impact continues to ripple across British society. But should we just understand all of this as a part of celebrity culture and the modern entertainment industry, or does the constitutional position of the British monarchy, including its continuing role in the governance of Northern Ireland, mean we should take these matters a bit more seriously? After all, Ireland as a whole was under the rule of the British Crown for far longer than it has been an independent republic, and it's hard to imagine that this has not had at least some residual impact on the way that Irish people approach politics. To discuss all of this, I am joined by our London editor, Dennis Staunton, and also by John Gibney. John is assistant editor with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series. He's also the editor of a book, Ireland and Monarchy, a selection of essays on the subject spanning more than 1,000 years of Irish history, so he's well qualified to comment. But I'm going to go to you first, Dennis, because we're 4 or 5 days on now from this interview. And is the whole Meghan and Harry thing, is it actually really consequential, or is it just a bit of entertainment fluff?
It's certainly a bit of entertainment, but it also is, I think, consequential. If you look back, the most immediate obvious comparison is the interview that Princess Diana did in 1995 with Martin Bashir, when she, similarly to Meghan Markle, revealed to the public her mental health problems. In her case, it was an eating disorder, and about the heartlessness, as she perceived it, of the palace. She described what was going on in her marriage. And this created something of a constitutional crisis, because she was married to the heir to the throne. She was the mother of Prince William, who was the in the direct line of succession. And so whatever happened to her and whatever she did in public had a potentially sort of constitutional impact, just in the way the whole thing was structured. That's not the case with Harry, because he's so far out of the picture in terms of the order of succession at this stage. But I think in some ways it's more dangerous. Because what it does is, with these allegations, particularly actually the one about racism, this suggestion that somebody in the royal family had expressed some concern about how dark Archie, their son's skin, would be before he was born, that this, it strikes at the legitimacy of the royal family to be the sort of the figureheads of a multicultural, multiracial Britain, and also their position as leaders of the Commonwealth. And so I think that it's, that in a sense, because the monarch doesn't really have any substantial or real constitutional powers in practice, or political powers, that actually it is this legitimacy. It's what Buckingham Palace refers to the Queen as having two roles, head of state and what they call head of nation. And this idea of being a unifying force, that's something which, if one of them is a racist in modern Britain, then that doesn't, it makes it much more difficult to fulfill that. So I think that really the import of this is both the fact that it divided people along generational lines in Britain, but also just this suggestion that these people are not a legitimate or an appropriate head of nation for this nation as it is today.
And in an analysis you wrote earlier this week for the Irish Times, you also suggested that that this particular event is notable because it's occurring at a moment of impending change. The Queen is in her late 90s now, so I think it's realistic to say that she won't be Queen in 10 years' time. There's a question of the succession. Does Charles take over at what would be a relatively advanced age himself? Or does it skip a generation? And what would a decision of that sort mean for legitimacy and primogeniture and all those things which are supposed to matter to kings and queens?
Yeah, the Queen is 94, so any actuarial study would suggest that she's probably in the home stretch at this stage. But if you again go back to Diana, when Diana died in 1997, there was a huge outpouring of hostility towards the royal family and towards the Queen specifically. But at that stage, they had time. And so over the subsequent few years, what you saw was a rehabilitation of the Queen herself, but also of Charles, to the point that in 2005, he was able to marry Camilla Parker Bowles, who's now the Duchess of Cornwall. And the plan really had been that Charles and this and the succession would be normalised. He has this ambition that Camilla should be Queen, which is still a controversial prospect. So in a way, his succession was always going to be a little bit tricky, partly because the Queen is in a special position by virtue of the fact that she's been there so long. She's a link with sort of the greatest generation of the Second World War. There's hardly anybody alive in Britain today that has known any other monarch on the throne. But when she goes, then the question might come. And again, if you look at some polling on this, a plurality of people would suggest that William ought to succeed the Queen rather than Charles. Now, they would normally, in normal circumstances, they'd kind of get over that, and Charles would simply become a fact. But I think, again, if you have something else adding into the mix, just this questioning the whole thing, that then, even if they decide to start doing something like skipping a generation, the danger of introducing anything other than the arbitrariness of birth order into this system is that if you ask yourself, do we need Charles, you might ask yourself, do we need any of them? And so that it actually does undermine the logic of a hereditary system.
John, I'd like to bring you in here for the Irish perspective and perhaps some historical context as well. I mean, there is a strange disjunction, it seems to me, in Irish commentary on this during the week, because on the one part there is a tendency to go, look at these ridiculous people with their antiquated ways of life. Let's point our fingers at them and laugh at it. But there's also an absolute fascination with it at the same time. And I'm kind of conscious, even if you look around my life in Dublin, that older buildings still bear the marks of the Crown. Certain institutions, including your own august institution, the Royal Irish Academy, still have the prefix Royal before their name. So there are traces, at least, of the long association between the British Crown and Ireland still among us. What I'm wondering is, are they vestigial traces, or is there something that runs deeper there?
Well, I suppose if you look at how Irish people are, I mean, many people around the world look at the British royal family, I mean, they are celebrities. I mean, they obviously have a state function and an official role within the United Kingdom and in the Commonwealth. But if you're outside those circles, so to speak, there's a certain, I think there's kind of a general public interest in the same way that there'd be interest in other celebrities. And I'm not kind of diminishing it here, but I think that is a big part of an enduring fascination many people outside the UK or Commonwealth have with the British royal family. Now, we've obviously, as a country, have had a rather different relationship with the royal family and their predecessors, and, or I should say, with the British monarchy over the centuries. Because, I mean, from 1541 up until 1937, I mean, the British monarchs were our heads of state, so to speak. And for much of that time, most of that time, we were explicitly under British rule. I mean, from 1541 onwards until the Act of Union, we were classed as a separate and distinct kingdom, though in reality probably more like a colony than what we would recognise as an independent kingdom. And then from 1801 until 1922, formally part of the UK, and then remaining within the Commonwealth ourselves for a period thereafter. And you might say that, I sometimes think that we don't necessarily have a problem with monarchy historically so much as a problem with British monarchy in its particular manifestations. I mean, if you went back to the 16th, 17th centuries, in that period, you would have seen the sense developing. And I would say that a sense of an affiliation with monarchy could happily coexist with an opposition to British rule or a resistance to British rule. I mean, in the 16th and 17th centuries, many of the Irish intelligentsia began to articulate a notion that Ireland had a crown of its own, that it was therefore a distinct kingdom. And one that, and that was an idea that was held in opposition to the rule of British monarchs over Ireland as well. And some British monarchs were welcomed as the natural kings of Ireland by the Irish intelligentsia, like the Stuart dynasty from Scotland, so to speak. And this idea of a crown of Ireland, it could be depicted as a physical object. It was sometimes alleged it had been realistically a physical object, but it was setting up one type of monarchy against another. Now, the thing is that it's not it's not an opposition to monarchy per se. And even if you look at, say, in the 18th century, I mean, probably the dominant ideology held by the Catholic Irish was Jacobitism, a support for the exiled House of Stuart, who William III had effectively ejected from the thrones of England, Ireland, and Scotland as they were then. Now, part of that was because the Stuart, there was a traditional loyalty on the part of the Catholic Irish to the Stuarts. There was a sense that, you know, a Stuart restoration could perhaps, I suppose, undo the conquest and the land confiscations of the 17th century and, I suppose, restore many Irish Catholic landowners and the Irish Catholic elite to what they felt and what they had actually lost. But you were still talking about loyalty to a monarchy and loyalty to a different monarchy. And even, you know, attempts to solicit assistance from continental powers in the 16th and 17th centuries, you know, for the Catholic cause in Ireland, they would solicit it from monarchies, the French monarchy, the Spanish monarchy. I mean, this wasn't, the point I'm making is that republicanism, as we see it, is something with fairly recent roots in Ireland. But there's a monarchical strain in Irish life that could coexist with a hostility or opposition to British rule. And obviously, you know, many people in modern Ireland, on the modern Ireland of Ireland, will view the British monarch as their head of state, and it's an important part of their identity. But there has been a strain in Irish life that has been, I suppose, not necessarily monarchist, but certainly wouldn't have had a problem with monarchy. And many Irish nationalists would fall into that camp or could be categorised in that way.
And there is a certain irony, isn't there, which has been remarked upon many times, is that the roots of Irish republicanism, real republicanism, opposition to monarchy as an unjust form of government, ruled by the people, for the people, came from the community which is now self-identifies as loyalist. In other words, the dissenter tradition in Northern Ireland who looked to their co-planters in North America and then later looked to the French Revolution. So that's where that republican, directly anti-monarchist tradition in Ireland comes from.
It's one of the roots. I mean, you know, you could trace it back further to dissenting congregations in the 17th century as well. But really, at the end of the 18th century, the American and especially the French revolutions, with their kind of, you know, tilting against monarchy, really brought the idea of republicanism, I suppose, into Irish life. And, you know, I mean, many republicans will live up to, you know, or attempt to, you know, live up to principles of, you know, secularism, equality, and so on and so forth. But very often you could use republicanism in the past two centuries as a shorthand for separatism. And separatism can take many forms, you know. It's a relatively recent phenomenon, but yeah, there's an irony in how it's evolved over time, you know. But another thing you'd point out about the period when republicanism placed roots in Ireland is that it came very soon after the cause of the House of Stuart had essentially come to an end. It was a busted flush. By the end of the 18th century, there was no real mileage in supporting the Stuarts, whether they're a monarchy or not. So you could say that the door was open for other ideologies to take root. But you did see, I mean, the Presbyterians of the North of Ireland were one of the most radical groups in late 18th century Ireland. Obviously, their political and ideological trajectory over the past two centuries is something you could have a very, very long discussion about. But there is an irony there in that, yeah, if we view Irish unionism and nationalism in purely sectarian terms, then the fact that many Republicans at the end of the 18th century were Anglicans and Presbyterians, you know, complicates that picture a lot. But that's a whole other story that we mightn't have time to get into here.
Well, you never know, we might. But Dennis, just to come back to your point about the really salient issue this week, which I agree with you, I think, was the question of race and racism, which was raised in the issue. I mean, there's always been a thing, hasn't there, about the British monarchy, which is that it represents privilege, it represents a ruling class, it goes back to concepts such as the divine right of kings, which may have been tamed by the constitutional settlements of the 18th century in the United Kingdom, but still, they're very deep-rooted, rather archaic notions. Essentially, I think most people looking at them from the outside would think of them as conservative notions, that the British royal family represents the kind of a strain of British conservatism. But sometimes, you know, they either stimulate radical revolution or they're seen as radical themselves. It's a very complex relationship with the British sense and maybe more particularly the English sense of national self-identity.
Yeah, you're right, because obviously although the Queen or the Sovereign doesn't actually in practice exercise much power, she has some formal powers in terms of giving royal assent to bills and in terms of the formation of the government, inviting a Prime Minister to form a government. But in practice, like all constitutional monarchs that want to survive, they don't overstep much of a mark there, because as soon as they poke their toe into political waters, they tend to get burnt. So instead, though, at the same time, the monarchy sits at the centre of this complex, a sort of a structure of deference in a sense. And so because there are these ancient parts of the English constitution that survived the end of the absolute monarchy in the 17th century. You know, the British were among the first to abolish absolutism. But in a way, the modern constitution that they created is much less modern in many of its forms than the 19th century constitutions that appeared elsewhere in Europe later on after a kind of a revolutionary period. So what you have is these structures like, say, the House of Lords, the honour system, which, although the House of Lords is mostly political appointees, there are still 90-something hereditary peers who elect one another. That's a remnant. There are, you know, the bishops are represented, the Anglican bishops are represented in there, you know, and also just the fact, the simple forms of the titles, the forms of the Order of the British Empire in terms of the honour system. It creates this, it reinforces a kind of structure of deference throughout society. It's something that a lot of people feel they can ignore, but it nonetheless, it is a kind of a conservative unifying structure, which comes in useful at moments of national crisis. But where the monarchy, I think, and the British royal family have been fairly good is that they have adapted as time has gone on. And so if you think, say, of a figure like Prince Charles, his enthusiasm for the environment and for conservation was actually before its time in terms of public opinion in Britain. Likewise, if you look at, say, the causes that Prince William and Prince Harry took up, in the last few years, a lot of them are to do with things like mental health. They tend to adapt themselves to the society that they're in. But I think the racism question is so much deeper because it's it doesn't just affect their relationship with the British people and the multicultural and multiracial nature of British society, but it is this business of the Commonwealth. And the Queen is the head of the Commonwealth. In 2018, the Commonwealth leaders decided that Prince Charles should succeed her, but they made clear that he wasn't succeeding her by right, that it wasn't a hereditary position to be to be head of the Commonwealth. And if, for example, the finger of suspicion were to point towards him with regard to this racist remark, or there was a suggestion that he might tolerate racism, then that position could come into question. And this is, again, one of the parts of the monarchy that's useful to the British state generally. It's part of Britain's soft power. As John was saying, these people are celebrities, but they're also, they work for the British state. And so you can send them to places, a royal visit, like most royal families in Europe, they're very small, so you just have the principals or the principals and their children and their immediate heir to the throne. But in the case of the British royal family, there are quite a lot of them. And if you send them off for a visit somewhere, even a relatively minor one, it'll get a few headlines, it will get a bit of attention, and it will add a little bit of luster to a trade mission that might otherwise not get very many headlines. And so, but if they somehow become a toxic brand, that's obviously an awful lot less useful.
Yeah, I've never understood that because they've always seemed a remarkably dull bunch to me. Well, I wouldn't want them visiting me, but, you know, each shakana sangu, I suppose. But, John, that whole, well, two issues there, really. One is, I mean, we're conscious in our own immediate recent past of the power, the symbolic power of visits with the visit of the Queen in 2011 and previous royal visits as well, that they do have a kind of something beyond a ceremonial power, kind of a representational power of some sort. But Dennis mentioned the Commonwealth there as well. And I did want to ask you about that because I know you have written about this, Ireland's relationship with the Crown in the years after the foundation of the Free State was quite different from what it is now. It gradually evolved under different administrations, first Cumann na n-Éill and then Fianna Fáil. And then a quite abrupt and I think somewhat surprising departure from the Commonwealth at the end of the 1940s. I do wonder, was it a mistake to leave the Commonwealth? Because it cut one of the last remaining ties between the two different parts of the island, didn't it?
Well, one person who seems to have been wary of leaving the Commonwealth, and many people might be surprised to hear this, would have been Eamon de Valera himself. We have to remember the Commonwealth now has evolved in particular ways that weren't apparent necessarily in the 30s and 40s and ultimately when we left it. And I suppose, the question of Commonwealth membership does come up in discussions over, hypothetical scenarios for Irish unity, would say Commonwealth membership be some way of, would be a kind of a concession to maintain a kind of some kind of residual link to the Crown for, as a concession to the Unionist opinion in Northern Ireland. That's an idea that goes back to the treaty in 1921. And I suppose there's one point that is worth picking up on there for what Dennis was saying. I mean, there is a parallel to the divisive question of race as it's being raised or raised around the royal family at the moment. The British monarchy was a Protestant monarchy and still is. And in 19th century Ireland, this was not something that was necessarily going to, this would have been an impediment to some degree to kind of fostering a kind of wider sense of loyalty amongst the Catholic population. Now, if you look at a lot of, say, Republicans and Nationalists, especially in advanced Republican and Nationalism at the start of the 20th century, I mean, Arthur Griffith advocated a dual monarchy based on the model of Austria and Hungary. I mean, this wasn't a Republican sentiment, so to speak. But very often, I think it's fair to say, a lot of Nationalists and Republicans, when it came to the crunch, were concerned with the substance of the freedom they sought as much as the form, or more so than the form. And it was seriously considered during the treaty debates in 1921, or the idea was floated, that it would be possible, potentially, to accept the link to the Crown if you had Irish unity. That would be the quid pro quo. Now, in the end, you didn't get, you got partition and a link to the Crown. But the idea that, you know, some kind of link with the Commonwealth or some kind of residual link to the monarchy could facilitate Irish unity, if it ever came about. That's an idea that was, it was there in 1921. Cumann na Gael pursued it in the 1920s. It seemed that Eamon de Valera was willing to keep a residual link. Well, he certainly was willing to keep a residual link to the monarchy and the empire as it was emerging in the 1930s. And he seems to have, and he may well have had reservations about the move to leave the Commonwealth in 1949. Because, I mean, if you look at the Commonwealth now, I mean, the majority of countries in our republics were elected heads of state. That wasn't the case in the 1930s or 40s. I mean, that was, the British hadn't evolved to that point where they could realise this was a feasible option. I mean, we left the Commonwealth in 1949 and became a republic because the two were seen as incompatible. India became a republic and remained within the Commonwealth not very long afterwards. If you really wanted to be cheeky about it, you might say they learned from our mistake. So it's not incompatible. I mean, the situation of a century ago or 80 years ago is very different to the way, to what we have now. Now, I mean, are we advocating joining the Commonwealth? Thing to bear in mind is that, well, what benefit would you get from this? I mean, it's worth asking the question, why rejoin an organisation that, you know, it's not just the Commonwealth has evolved, we have evolved away from it, you know? And if it was, I mean, if you were to argue, and I'm not taking a position on this in any way, shape or form, but if you were to argue that it would be a worthwhile concession to Unionists, I mean, the Good Friday Agreement does allow for dual citizenship provisions that currently pertain in Northern Ireland to be applied to an All-Ireland state if an All-Ireland state was to come about. So you could keep British citizenship potentially in a United Ireland down the line. Would Commonwealth membership be relevant to us? I mean, would we be talking, if, you know, a discussion was had about joining the Commonwealth, on what terms do you join? Do you join as a Commonwealth realm and thereby replace our elected presidency with a British monarch? Or do you join as a republic and retain that? So there's a lot of questions in relation to the potential model of a future United Ireland. It's something, there's a lot of things to be teased out there and a lot of issues to be dealt with. But the idea of using the Commonwealth or that link to the British monarchy as a means of facilitating Irish unity, it's as old as partition.
And it's still going on, Dennis, and we've had discussions on this podcast over the last while. There's these discussions ramp up about pre-discussions, I suppose, about Irish reunification and recognising the British identity of Ulster Unionists. I do still wonder, and I wonder whether this is not what your hat as London editor, but your hat as an Irishman. How do you think that would play? I'm not sure. There is, as part of this whole picture of the way that Ireland now thinks about the monarchy and the British monarchy in particular, there is a kind of a revulsion against the sort of cultural cringe that I recall. I think it was back in the late 90s when John Bruton was Taoiseach, and he seemed a little bit overexcited about the arrival of Prince Charles, you know, and there was a general sharp intake of breath at that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Irish people's attitudes to the British monarchy are actually generally fairly relaxed. I mean, they tend to go up and down depending on how people are feeling about Britain in general. And so over the last few years with Brexit, there's been, Irish people have generally tended to look at Britain and see, you know, this kind of, you know, what they regarded as an irrational political environment and, you know, foolish decisions. Brexit was perceived as a kind of a spasm of imperial nostalgia. I'm not sure that's what it was, but anyway, that's, I think, a lot of Irish people saw it that way. And I imagine that then that the royal family and the monarchy would have been sort of wrapped up in all of that. I tend to agree with John that joining the Commonwealth wouldn't actually persuade very many unionists of anything, really. I mean, I think if you were to have a new state encompassing the whole of the island, then certainly you might argue that those people who live in Northern Ireland who are attached to Britain and the British identity should not be yanked out of the Commonwealth. And so in that sense, it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't kill everybody else to join it. And, you know, but again, it's a question of sort of what is the advantage. I think it probably wouldn't do any harm in those circumstances, but I also don't think that it would achieve the desired effect, you know, in as an effort to persuade people. But I think just to go back to the notion of what Irish people think of the monarchy, I think that because we're exposed to so much of the British media, we kind of see much more of, and because the monarchy tends to be a popular, subject, both for the newspapers and the broadcast media, then, Irish people tend to be exposed to it. But as you pointed out yourself, it is, the interview was the biggest, the most viewed program on RTE, and our own newspaper or our website suggests that there's a certain amount of interest in this story among our readers.
Yeah, there's a very telling essay in the book about Ireland and the monarchy, John, about the early days of television. And in this part of the world, the coronation of Queen Elizabeth played a very important part in the rollout of television to the parts of the UK that didn't have it yet. And equally across the Irish Sea, across down the eastern seaboard, there were all kinds of frantic efforts to get aerials up on top of hills and things to watch this and to get decent reception. And in a way, that sort of exemplifies the kind of marrying of showbiz and politics, which the modern royal family is.
So you're talking about an essay by Brian Lynch, who, if I'm not mistaken, well, former RTE archivist. And yeah, I mean, one detail that pops up in that particular essay is that it was a pub in Marlborough Street that installed a TV to show the coronation, and a customer smashed it with an axe. So it was kind of, tensions could be high about these things, but it goes back to the point that, there's a certain amount of celebrity and, glitz and, if you want to call it, glamour about the British royal family that that fascinates people. And even if, when British monarchs would have visited Ireland at the end of the 19th century or the early 20th century, they might have been met by substantial crowds. They would have been met by protesters as well. Many of those crowds would have been, unionist or loyalist in their politics. Many probably were just curious. All those people who would have welcomed Queen Elizabeth when she came here a couple of years ago, doesn't make them monarchists necessarily, So, it's interesting to see people buying TVs in the early 50s to watch the coronation of a British queen. But I suppose it's kind of a sense of, probably as much from a sense of curiosity that is still knocking around, as much as any kind of ideological or political principle.
Finally, Dennis, can I ask you something? And I mentioned Patrick Frayne's column at the start, and Patrick, I think, does a pretty good job on exploring the sheer weirdness of a royal family in the 21st century. And I'm struck by the way that Harry referred to it, slightly ironically, referred to the family as the firm, which has a ring of kind of East End underworld about it. And the whole business of marrying into this operation, it does seem more like The Godfather or The Sopranos than any other parallel I can think of. Maybe the Trumps are similar in some ways. You marry in and you become an employee. I was particularly struck by the revelation that at one point Meghan approached HR to see if they could help with some of her problems, which is not really something that normally happens in a family dispute.
No, and it's obviously not a normal family. But I think also we should probably distinguish between the British royal family and constitutional monarchies in general. I mean, there are 11 of them in Europe, and some of these, like you know, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden are among the most progressive countries in the world. Some of these countries are more progressive even, perhaps, than our own country in some ways. And so, you know, so the form of constitutional monarchy is actually not incompatible with modernity or being a progressive society. But if you look at those, I mean, many of these monarchies across Europe have had their problems. The Spanish monarchy recently, because of the corruption of the king, Juan Carlos, who was something of a hero in his day, in his younger days. But so that monarchy has had problems. But if you look, say, at the Danish monarchy, which is in a way comparable with the British monarchy, because it's also very old, it goes back 1,000 years or so, and the monarchy, the royal family is very small. It's just the king, the queen, her consort, and the crown prince and the crown princess. And so, in a way, what they don't have, like, they have more or less the same kind of function. And there is a lot of interest in the family, from the media. But they just don't have somehow the same extended network of A-list, B-list, C-list, Z-list celebrities within this whole kind of family structure. So I think that there is, you know, there's the fact that the British royal family are bigger celebrities than their royal counterparts elsewhere in Europe and around the world. And also, they're more familiar to us. And then, for one reason or another, they really have produced quite a lot of these characters. And you can go back, I mean, just if you just think of the Queen's reign herself, I mean, not even bothering to go back to Edward and Mrs. Simpson, but you know, her own sister, Princess Margaret, was a very colorful character. Sarah Ferguson did an interview with Oprah Winfrey about her marriage into the royal family, where she went through almost exactly the same things. I'm not quite as lurid as what Meghan Markle had to say. But in a way, this kind of playing out the drama in public, and the public, and I think Patrick made a very good point about this, that these people live in luxury, but they've got very little personal autonomy. And so there is this, and that again, I think, was in a way one of the most damaging things that Harry said when he suggested that his father and his brother were trapped in this institution. And he also said that there was an invisible contract between the royal family and the press, and that the royal family lived in terror of the press. And so this idea of these people trapped in an institution which was doing them and perhaps other people not much good, and living in terror of this kind of rather rabid tabloid press, it wasn't a very flattering picture.
Well, I suppose one thing that the royal family does depend upon probably is you know, transmitting a sense of perfection, and imperfections and flaws they're not good PR. I mean, you know, when the racist comment was reported and was alleged, I mean, I'd say a lot of people began to think, well, who in the royal family might have form in that department for making comments of a similar nature over the years? And equally, there's the current kind of focus upon, you know, Harry and Meghan, it's understandable given the news cycle. But not too long ago, there's another member of the royal family with some very, very serious allegations hanging around him in the form of Prince Andrew. So we can't forget that. And you kind of, you know, you sometimes wonder, is the current tabloid frenzy over Meghan Markle at the moment a way to distract attention from something that's far more, you know, in some ways, you know, far more sordid and serious potentially based on what's being alleged or what has been alleged about a senior member of the royal family and, the Queen's own son. So, you know, in some ways, I think it's a certain jaundiced view of the British royal family isn't a bad thing either.
No, although it's quite striking here because, first of all, Harry and Meghan did actually generate this media frenzy themselves by giving the interview in this particular case. But, you know, the generational divide in terms of people supporting, you know, taking sides in this here is very striking that most young people who express a view, they favour Harry and Meghan. Most old people think they've behaved appallingly. But I have a friend here who runs a Marxist political foundation, and two women in their 20s who work there and who are absolutely committed socialists and really on the radical left, they, the following day, were just rhapsodizing about, you know, how Harry and Meghan had, you know, had freed themselves from this thing, and speaking about these people as if they somehow mattered in their lives, and as if they were actually, you know, as if these were, you know, Meghan was in some way a symbol of liberation in a way that, I mean, It just seemed odd in that context. But it certainly, you know, there's no question but it has gripped the imagination in unlikely places.
And isn't that why republicanism will never prevail there, Dennis?
Well, it won't until it does, I suppose. You know, that it's, for republicanism to happen, you know, the monarchy has to go. And I think, as we were saying, you know, all these monarchs, all these systems which depend on a handful of people, and these people chosen essentially in an arbitrary fashion, you just can't tell, how things are going to turn. And so, I mean, it is very possible at each moment in the chain of succession that something goes wrong, and that and that the system ends. And if it ends, and you don't have a constitutional monarchy, then you would have a republic.
One thing to point out about that, following on from what Dennis said, is that there's been numerous dynasties on who've occupied the English and British thrones over the centuries. And at least one occasion, the British did get rid of their monarchy in the 17th century in a fairly brutal and kind of terminal manner. Now, they brought it back, but, you know, it's not impossible that lightning can strike twice sometimes.
Never say never. We will leave it there. Listen, thanks very much indeed to Dennis and to John. Thanks to our producers, Suzanne Brennan and JJ Vernon, our engineer. Give us an email at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. We'll be back very soon. But thanks very much indeed for listening.